This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The blog is called Wit's End. So far, it's been read over 11 million times. The author, I want to say artist, really, is Gail Zawacki. She's edgy. She's on a campaign to save trees from air pollution. But mostly, Gail's in a battle against the never-ending conceits humans use to pretend about ourselves. Gail, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. I can't believe it's 11 million. I think most of those are mishits. Like, they're looking for something else and they land on my blog and go, oh no, I don't want to be here.
Actually, it's really well written. The pictures are great. The subject is passionate. I know why people come. I love reading it, even though it hurts sometimes. Why is the Cheshire Cat your icon?
Oh, wow. That's such a good question. I guess I've always loved Lewis Carroll and the whole notion of absurdity. And in fact, lately I've gotten immersed in Camus' writings again about that. And the Cheshire Cat is just such a sort of cynical, sneering, laughing figure that I guess that's why I didn't really think about why I chose it. I just sort of did.
Well, look, you just blasted the big green group Conservation International and their movie stars who are pretending to speak for nature. What's the problem with that?
Right. I really didn't pick on them because they're movie stars. I just happened to come across one of the videos. That's the first one that Julia Richards did. And I see those actors, these very wealthy people, her and Harrison Ford and Robert Redford and the other people that are speaking in the videos, not as giant hypocrites really, but more like giant figures of all of us, where they are advocating that we take care of nature, but in their own lives, they are absolutely destroying nature much faster than anybody can dream of with their private jets and their multiple homes and their, you know, really outsized carbon footprints and so forth. So I did kind of use them more as an example because the extremity of the difference between what they're claiming they're working for and what they're actually doing in their lives is so outsized. I just found it kind of amusing, actually.
Okay, now this September, there was a big climate march in nearby New York City. It's nearby to you, trying to motivate the United Nations and world leaders to finally do something, anything, about climate change. Why didn't you go?
Well, it's not near me. I mean, I did go on to the Monday, Flood Wall Street. I didn't go to the one on Saturday. I would have gone, to be honest, because I have a lot of criticisms of 350 and the whole movement and the whole sort of progressive liberal uselessness of it all. But they're the only game in town. I mean, and I went to Occupy Wall Street for the same reason. I didn't agree with all of their stated goals or their premises, but at least they're doing something besides watching TV and munching, you know, Cheetos. So I would have gone Saturday, but my daughter was to be honest, was in a horse show, and I didn't want to miss seeing her because it was kind of a big deal. So I went to see her Saturday, and I felt a little bit better about it when I learned that there was going to be this other action on Monday that was related. So I went to the Monday.
And how did that go? Flood Wall Street. How'd that go for you?
That was a fiasco. I may never do any more activism again after that. It was so disappointing. I met with one friend that I'd planned to meet, and I ran into another friend that I hadn't planned to meet. And so the three of us were quite dismayed because we had specifically gone because we were told it was presented as an arrest, as, you know, civil disobedience. We're going to march onto Wall Street. We're going to sit down in front of the stock market and we're going to be arrested. And I felt like, well, that's a little more interesting to me. It's a little more of a statement than just having a Sunday parade when you're not disrupting traffic and you've got a permit, you wave some signs and go home. So we were there for that purpose, and the whole thing was derailed, and it may be forever a mystery exactly what happened, that the police, the mayor's office made some kind of deal with the organizers, and whether they were just blindsided, taken by surprise, or whether they were complicit from the beginning, I don't know, but they decided not to go for the civil disobedience arrest, and they stopped short of marching onto Wall Street. And there was a lot of discussion. We three were not the only angry people there. There were some very vocally furious people that they had gone to a lot of trouble. And also it's just it's a big emotional ordeal to decide to be arrested because there's always the risk of getting injured and, you know, course, losing your liberty is always frightening. And so it's a, you know, people who had made that choice, and there were several hundred people that had gone through that process, to have it sort of snatched away from them by the, arbitrarily by the organizers who are supposed to be, oh, this is a equal organization, bottom up decision making. And they just announced, no, we're stopping here. It was very distressing. So yeah, it was just sad. It was just a big, giant, epic failure, in my opinion.
Well, you know, it seems to me it's a little more risky in the United States than it is in, say, Canada or Britain or Australia to have a protest. I mean, it always amazes me, Gail, when Americans see U.S. troops kicking in doors in Iraq, they don't seem to realize that these same guys come back and go to work for the police or the prisons with many of the same weapons donated by the Pentagon. That population control and force is so well developed in America, it seems hard to imagine any kind of rebellion, no matter how bad things get. Is revolution even possible in America?
I doubt it. But I have to say that, I mean, people in other countries really do get their heads cracked quite a lot in demonstrations, including in Britain and Canada and, you know, anywhere you might name. And then, of course, in even more lawless countries, they get murdered in the middle of the night. You know, a lot of forest activists and people like that. So I don't think that police actions are the reason that Americans have a revolution. I think there are other systemic reasons that Americans are not willing at this point to into the streets the way, for instance, the people in Hong Kong have been. I'm not really sure what all those reasons are, but a lot of it is just, it's fear. I think when people see themselves sliding down the economic ladder, they're less likely not to protest. And then you also have the whole student loan. I mean, when I first started Occupy Wall Street, I kind of thought they were a bunch of whiny kids about their student loans. And then I realized that it actually is a very effective way of suppressing dissent, because traditionally young people are the ones that are dissenters, but now they're all obligated into this debt that can never be discharged, and they can't afford to risk arrest and to be protesting because they've got to keep their jobs and keep paying their student loans. So it is a pretty pernicious way that the government has figured out to keep the youth of the country subdued.
Well, let's switch gears to your personal battle to show people leaves. Gail, why is your blog filled with photos of blotchy plants and dying trees?
Well, I guess because nobody else is really doing very much about it. I mean, there has certainly been many, many, many scientists and hundreds and thousands of research papers written about what air pollution does to plants and trees. But there is almost nobody who's actually saying, it's not just something that we should be writing papers about and studying. It's actually causing the ecosystem to collapse globally. And most, virtually all scientists shy away from that. And the ones that do come out and say things a little stronger get ridiculed by other scientists. A famous example, well, the only famous in my little world, is the authors of An Appalachian Tragedy, who did come out and say, they wrote a book, it came out in 1999, it said that ozone pollution is killing trees from Georgia up to Maine. And of course, you can extrapolate that to the entire world, but this was their area of specialty. And I got in a little bit of a tiff with Howie Neufeld, who works with the EPA on the ozone issue, and he's working, you know, been working with them on their new regulation, which is due every 5 years. It's coming up in 2015. And I said to him, I wrote to him, I was quite angry, and I said, why aren't you jumping up and down with your hair on fire? You know about ozone. You know the issue. Why aren't you saying that this is a huge problem for the entire ecosystem? And I said, have you read An Appalachian Tragedy? And he wrote back and he said, the only tragedy is that that book ever got written. Because the scientists who wrote it were just ridiculed by the establishment forestry world, which is in the back pocket of the lumber industry, which is part of the fossil fuel industry. And it's almost, you could almost put on a tinfoil hat here and say that there's a conspiracy of silence. So I guess I write about it because I just feel that it's so important and people need to know about it, and nobody else is really saying that.
In an email, you mentioned to me that Jack Fishman was speaking out about it. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Jack Fishman, I just came across a few months ago, his work. He wrote a book in, I think it was 1990, called Global Alert. Now, you can't get a little much more alarmist than Global Alert, which is the title of the book. And I read it, and I was like, holy cow, the whole thing is about how ozone is killing trees. And he is a very distinguished scientist, was working at, I think it was University of Colorado then, and I'm not sure where he is now, but he's worked with Noah. He was one of Paul Crutzen's graduate students, and he worked very closely with Paul Crutzen about the ozone hole in the stratosphere. And what happened was when they were studying the hole in the stratosphere, they started asking themselves, and this is way back, I guess, in the early 80s, what's happening with ozone in the troposphere, because they couldn't separate it when they looked at the layers from satellites. So he worked on that, and that too was ridiculed. Oh, don't be silly. There can't be ozone in the troposphere. You know, people can't be making that much pollution that it's an issue. And it turns out that it is an issue. So he wrote this book, and at the end of it, there was an epilogue dated 2004. And it was all about how his daughter had grown up, and the world was so much better because the pollution problem had been taken care of, and so on and so forth. So I wrote to him, "Dear Dr. Fishman, I'm sure you know your business a lot better than I do, but do you really think that pollution's gotten better? Because with China and the precursors are traveling around the world now, it's gotten so much worse." And he wrote back to me rather sardonically, and he said, "The epilogue was a fantasy. It was a hopeful fantasy." And he said, "Unfortunately, it's still a fantasy." And I said, "Oh, okay." And since then, he's actually sent to me a link to a lecture that maybe only had 100 views on YouTube that he gave for Paul Crutzen's 80th birthday celebration at the Max Planck Institute. And he started off with some sort of sentimental, personal things about their relationship. And then he went into what ozone is doing to the biosphere. And the title of his lecture was, "Are We Creating a Toxic Atmosphere?" Again, you can't get a whole lot more alarmist than that, because it was a rhetorical question. The answer is yes, our atmosphere it's poisonous. And that's what he talked about. But even Dr. Fishman, much as I revere him for the work he's done, is not jumping up and down with his hair on fire, because scientists just don't do that. So what he's doing is he's working on making these ozone gardens for children in arboretums and science museums, where they grow plants that are notoriously susceptible to ozone, that happen to show visible damage more than others, like on their leaves. And so that children can go to the gardens and say, "Oh, look what our air pollution is doing to the plants." And I'm like, well, that's wonderful, but there's no time left to educate the children. That's not what we need to be doing, because they're not going to inherit a habitable climate at this rate, let alone plants that, you know, the monarch butterflies can feed off of. So that's my story on Dr. Fishman. And I did actually transcribe some excerpts from his book in a blog post of mine. If people want to read part of it, they can, or you can Google it online and read excerpts in Google Books. But it's a great book. Yeah, I think it was called "There Goes the Neighborhood." So if you Google my blog and "There Goes the Neighborhood," you'll find my email exchanges with him and parts of his book there, and a link to his lecture, which is really, really worth watching.
I'll do all that, and I'll put the links in my blog too at ecoshock.info. This is Radio EcoShock with the witty blogger and activist from New England, Gail Zawacki. On the other hand, Gail, you seem nervous about what would happen if governments in North America or China suddenly took action and cleaned up air pollution, or maybe there could be a stock market crash, which seems to be happening right now, which would close the factories and ground the commuters, or maybe a disease like Ebola could shut the system down for a few weeks or months. If pollution stops for any reason, what happens?
Well, we'll heat up quite a bit. There's a great BBC documentary that came out several years ago called Global Dimming. It's just riveting to see how they learned that the aerosol pollution is masking warming. And Mark Jacobson, who's a professor at Stanford, was on that late night, I can't remember his name, but he was on one of those, I guess, the Late Show or whatever. And he was talking about, he's actually believes in green technology saving the world, but he said that it's masking half of the warming. So in other words, if the pollution was gone from the skies, it will get twice as warm almost instantly, which is huge, because you can see what the warming we've had so far is already doing in terms of the crazy weather that we have and the extreme floods and the droughts and so on and so forth. So it's very significant. And I don't really think it's going to happen because governments get their act together and clean up pollution. I don't think they're ever going to do that. But I think it will happen when we have a collapse of industrial civilization. And that at some point is inevitable. I don't know when. And I'm not sure what is going to trigger it. Could be, like you said, it could be Ebola. It could be an economic crash. It could be peak oil. Any number of things. But it certainly is not going to continue forever. And when it does come to an end, you are going to have instant, almost instant heating, because those aerosols will filter out within a matter of weeks. They'll be gone.
Well, Gail Zawacki, neither one of us is scientists, but we both try hard to keep up with the science as best we can. And my own worry is that if we get a few very hot years or even hot months, natural systems will shift and they won't go back, even if the temperature drops back down again, or maybe that an unnaturally warmer climate doesn't cool down even if the trigger is removed. What are your thoughts?
I would say we're past the tipping point. I mean, you read a lot of ecology papers, and they warn about approaching tipping point. And it's the same thing that a lot of scientists say. They're always saying, oh, it's 5 minutes till midnight. And my question is, when is it ever going to be midnight? You've been saying 5 minutes to midnight 50 years now. I think we're past the tipping point. Well, for instance, I think you just did a segment on that World Wildlife Fund story that we've lost 50% of wildlife population in the last 40 years. I call that a tipping point. 90% of the large ocean fish are gone. So that's well worse than that World Wildlife Fund report, shocking as that is. So the tipping points have been crossed. We're never going to go back to a healthy biosphere in terms of what humans need to survive.
You know, I suppose New Englanders know about an unsteady climate. You had winters where people played tennis in New York in January, and then a brutally cold winter from the Arctic. You had a series of storms, like Hurricane Irene was just laden with surprising amounts of rain, and that pounding from Hurricane Sandy. That must have people there on the edge, or do people just quickly forget about all that and go on about their daily lives?
Well, I think for the most part, they forget and they go, I mean, it's like the UK is a good example. They've had the most unbelievable flooding for the last 2 years. And I have friends that say it's ridiculous how quickly people forget. But I do also think that it's unsettling in a deeper level. I think there's a kind of anxiety that is pervasive. And I think that you can see it in popular culture, like a Radio Lab just did this great segment on nihilism, and whether it's a new phenomenon or whether it's always been there, or, you know, what's causing it to sort of really seep into popular culture right now. It's wonderful. Actually, they did two segments on it. And I think that there's always been a sense, going back to Malthus and well before, that mankind is very foolish. I mean, the Greeks talked about it quite a bit, and I don't know Chinese culture very well at all, but I'll bet you anything they had their Cassandras as well. And the reason is that I think it's just so obvious on a very basic level that you cannot continue to grow forever on a finite planet. And yet that is what all of our activities are predicated on, is the notion that, you know, a couple can have 5 or 10 children and we can, you know, continually expand. We can take over more and more habitats. We can destroy more and more animals, blow up more mountains, and it won't matter because we'll just invent new technology. On the face of it, that's ludicrous. But most people don't question it. And if they do question it, they quickly stop questioning it and move on, because the implications are really frightening. And very few people, and it's an interesting question to me as to why it is that there are so few people and what distinguishes those few people that actually will stare into the abyss, which was the title of one of those Radiolab stories that I was talking about. There must be some kind of mechanism, or maybe life trauma event or genetic mutation. I don't know what it is that causes some people to be able to do that. And I was actually just thinking about it this morning, because in addition to Lewis Carroll and all of his Alice in Wonderland stuff, I've always loved the Wizard of Oz story, especially if you read the original books, not just the movie, which is also great, but the original books are really fascinating. And that idea of in the Emerald City, where people all had the green glasses, people look through life through a distorted lens, which is in their brain. It makes them have an optimism bias. I mean, there's all kinds of more recent neurological studies and things that have shown that people really aren't in the driver's seat. They're driven by their optimism and their desire to believe that the future is predictable, and also more fundamentally that they're never going to die. But every now and then, somebody doesn't have those green glasses on, or they have them and they lose them. And it's very interesting to me to look at different people that were able to do that, like Bosch. I've been looking at his paintings lately, and he was very into the symbolism of whether or not people have free choice and the anxiety. And there were myths in the 1400s, very prevalent myths about how people feel constant anxiety because they have to make the choice between good and evil. Good and evil being living it sustainably as good, and evil as being foolish, like Ship of Fools. That's where I came at it from, with that whole metaphor of the ship of fools.
Yeah, Hieronymus Bosch, he was in the 1300s, 1400s, somewhere in there?
1400s, yeah. Late 1400s, early 1500s. But he was drawing on even earlier mythology. The Ship of Fools came well before him, and it was just, it was the way that people lived then, was that they understood that there's a fundamental tension between people's appetites and greed and what they need to do to be prudent. And it's funny to me because right now our kind of current religion in America among environmentalists, a lot of them, is sort of this noble savage theory of indigenous people that they were more close to the earth and understood nature. But that does two disservices. Indigenous people were no more sustainable than, you know, white European supremacists. They also went into overshoot with population and they had constant warfare and battles, and you know, this has been well documented in archaeology. It's a universal with every biological creature that they go into overshoot and their population crashes, and then as they have more food, they grow, and then this is just a constant in life in general. But the sort of mythology of the noble savage not doing that and living sustainably, it, to me, it's ignorant. And the more I read, the more I realize how ignorant I am about how well studied these issues have been going back centuries and centuries, ever since you can go through any kind of written record. This is something that people have been grappling with unsuccessfully, because we can sometimes intellectually see that there are limits. I mean, look at the Limits to Growth report that came out in 1972. That was pretty comprehensive, but so people can intellectually read about that, but they just reject it because it would require sacrifice on their part, and people don't want to sacrifice.
That's a tough question. Why some people get it and others don't. I like to think most of my listeners do get it, which is kind of nice at least. What is your position on the near-term extinction argument posed by Professor Guy McPherson?
That's something I tend to skirt just a little bit, because I'm not sure it really matters, because I think that we're headed for such a crash that if any people manage to survive, they are going to envy the dead. I think it's going to be extremely ugly because it's going to be global, because we're so interconnected now, and because there's so many of us. So I take exception with Guy on some of his presentations, and I'm not 100% convinced that the methane class rates are going to fire in a short time frame. They might. I'm not saying they won't, but I'm not saying I'm sure that they will. And if they do on a longer time frame, we may not be around to see it, or most of us may not be around to see it. So I really admire him for bringing up the near-term extinction, because I think it's a possibility. And I also think that it's good for people to be able to talk openly about that prospect, because it raises all of these essential questions about how we live and who we really are that don't get discussed by the sort of techno-fantasist people that think that we're going to get out of this basic predicament we're in with technology. Like, I was just reading that the World Bank came out and said that they're so thrilled because China has come on board to impose a carbon tax. And my reaction was, well, great, when we have a baby tax, then I'll think we're getting somewhere. Because the whole carbon issue is just one symptom of overshoot. The other symptoms, like for instance that World Wildlife Report that came up earlier, when they talk about species disappearing, they only attribute 7% of the loss to climate change. The rest is habitat destruction, just outright killing and poisoning them, all the pollution. These are the big killers. I'm not saying that climate change won't ultimately be the big mama of killers. It will be. But right now, even if you didn't have climate change, we're destroying the Earth. We're destroying a habitable Earth.
I think we're going to have to talk about the big daddy of killers to be accurate. So what's in your book, Pillage, Plunder, and Pollute, LLC?
That book is mostly about ozone and what it's doing to trees. The agronomists around the world know. And in fact, New York Times just had an article come out in September that Justin Gillis wrote about ozone. And the fact that they know that it's already causing annual crop to be diminished in the quantity that is produced, but also in the quality, so that they don't have the same nutritive value. So the article was just infuriating to me because he talks about it and the researchers he talks to about it look at it purely and how can we genetically engineer crops to be less vulnerable to the impact of ozone? So this is wrong on so many levels. First of all, one of the worst things about ozone isn't the direct damage it does, although that's quite bad. It's the secondary issues with the insects and the fungus and the disease that start attacking plants that have been weakened by ozone. That impact is phenomenal. It's like climate. Like, it's like CO2 is the initial forcing with climate, but what really gets you is the amplifying feedback, like ice melt and the change in albedo. Those are far more important, and that's what pushes you over those tipping points than the initial CO2. And the same thing is with ozone. Ozone is very, very bad for plants. But when you add in the insects and the disease and the fungus that come after, that's what really wipes stuff out. So when they're talking about annual crops and trying to find crops that are more resistant, that doesn't do anything for the wild plants that are out there that, in a larger sense, we're more dependent on, you know, for oxygen and just making rainfall and keeping the world from turning into a desert and things like that. So if you engineer annual crops, it does nothing, well, for perennial crops, because the damage is cumulative. So all those things like, you know, rhubarb and asparagus and stuff, that they get damaged year after year after year. And that's true even more for trees. So especially trees out in the wild. I mean, you can engineer as many crops as you want, but what kind of a monoculture are we going to live in, even presuming they do it, which they've been trying for years and they really have not had much success. Anyway, the book is really mainly about those issues.
We're going to have to wrap it up there, Gail. I'll ask you about the Apocalypse Library another time. I'll toss a link in that to my blog at ecoshock.info. We've been talking with Gail Zawacki. I find her blog called Wit's End is kind of addictive. Gail is passionate. She's witty herself. She ties together threads that make sense, as you can hear. You can find the blog at witsendnj.blogspot.com. So that's witsendnj.blogspot.com, or find a link in my show blog. And you can also download that book, Pillage, Plunder, and Pollute, at the website. Gail, thank you so much for visiting with us.
Thank you so much, Alex. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's a shame to end. I know we could talk for an hour, but I've really got a lot from our conversation so far, and I hope to have you back again.
Okay. Talk to you soon. Take care.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.